I have very fond memories of Dallas. It's a great joy to be back in this city, though it's been probably a decade since I've been here, except to pass through maybe on my way to the East Coast from Los Angeles. I could almost pack my bags and go home now because last night was such a stirring event for me to see so many people that I know have known across the years in this gathering, to be inspired by the opportunity, the first time in my life, to meet Lloyd Faust, a man whose music I've known across the years, and whose music we sing in our congregation at Holman with great joy and power, and to see Bishop Pope, a man for whom I've had the deepest respect and friendship across the years, to look forward to seeing my dear friends Joe Washington and Baxton Bryant, colleagues of now over 20 years of mission and ministry in different parts of the country. It's just really good to be here, and I count it as a very rare privilege to be among you, among Methodism in Texas, which shows such vigor, with which I'm constantly in dialogue through the United Methodist Reporter, if none other. I want to lift up for our thinking this morning a few verses from the 19th chapter of the Gospel according to Luke. And I'm reading from the 41st verse. When Jesus came in sight of the city, he wept over it and said, "If only you had known on this great day the way that leads to peace. But know it is hidden from your sight. For a time will come upon you when your enemies will set up siege works against you. They will encircle you and hem you in on every point. They will bring you to the ground, you and your children, within your walls. They will not leave you one stone standing on another. Because you did not recognize God's moment when it came." That reading, of course, according to the New English translation of the Bible. I'm sure that we all know the name of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, Christian of rather giant proportions, who stands astride the Christian church as one of the singular voices of God for our own time, though in his time he was hardly recognized as such. You will know something of the anguish with which he was a pastor, theologian, friend, churchman in Germany in critical years. You may not be aware as much, however, of the great group of ecumenical friends across the world who recognized that Bonhoeffer was in real danger and hoped that they could persuade him to leave Germany for a safer place on the earth. He resisted many, many overtures. But finally, in the spring of 1939, he agreed reluctantly to move to New York City and there take up ministering to the growing number of German refugees in that city. He came reluctantly in June. He wrestled with the Lord across the summer. By September, he was persuaded that he dare not remain in New York if he would be obedient to the Spirit. And so he returned in that month to Germany. But before he left our shores, he wrote a letter to Reinhold Niebuhr. And in that letter, he had these fateful words: "Christians in Germany will face the terrible alternative, either of willing the defeat of their nation in order that Christian civilization may survive, or willing the victory of their nation and thereby the defeat of our civilization, the destroying of our civilization, a terrible, terrible alternative." Especially from a man who was steeped in the very soil of his land, who knew as a Christian the soul of his people, who loved his people and his nation as only a true patriot can love, who was a man of culture and sensitivity, a man of compassion, who wrestled with demons in his own time and for and among his own people. A terrible alternative. And with that sense, he returned to Germany, and there you know the story well. He worked, fought, suffered, travailed. On April the 9th, 1945, became a martyr to the rapaciousness of Hitler. A terrible alternative indeed. An alternative that was not acceptable in his own time, neither to the powers of Germany or Russia, United States, or any place else in the world. Completely unacceptable. But nevertheless, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, I think we need to remember, stood in the mainstream of prophetic understanding of one caught in the grip of God's will and purpose. Recall for just a moment those few verses in the chapter 21 of Jeremiah, which occurs somewhere around the year perhaps of 586 BC. Nebuchadnezzar, the Chaldean forces are moving across Palestine. They threaten, of course, Judah and Jerusalem. King Zedekiah decreases all of the appropriations for the well-being of his people in order that he might build the great stone-throwing machines, that he might fortify the city of Jerusalem. Jerusalem is soon under siege. But Zedekiah, the king, has enough sense to recognize that there is a will of God somewhere in the world for Jerusalem. And so he sends Pashur and Zephaniah, the priest, to the prophet Jeremiah and says, "Is there a word for me today? Is there a word for our time and for our land?" And Jeremiah speaks thusly in these words: "Listen, I, the Lord, am giving you a choice between the way of life and the way of death." Terrible alternative. But Jeremiah, being the preacher that he is, does not just simply make a general statement. He then becomes quite specific about what that choice is all about. And he goes on. "I, the Lord," he speaks, "am moving against you with outstretched arm. I'm your chief enemy. And I do so in anger, wrath, and judgment." And secondly, Jeremiah says to the people, the choice is clear if you want to live. The fortifications of Jerusalem will not save you. Tear them down. Leave the city.
out into the deserts and the plains and meet the Chaldeans halfway. Your life will be spared. You will have your life. Remain in the city, and you will surely die. Now, Jeremiah was not talking from the point of view of the Secretary of State, who understood the geopolitics of his world and saw the possibilities of the Jewish empire having its reign and its power. He was rather speaking simply and humbly as a prophet of God, who recognized that God had thrown across Jerusalem the gauntlet. And the gauntlet found Jerusalem disobedient and unfaithful, an untoward generation, that they could move to every sort of military alliance that they wished to, but in them they would not find any security or safety. That their only safety was to rely on the Lord and understand a choice between the way of life and between the way of death. No longer rely upon their arms. Go and confront the enemy unarmed. See what the possibilities then were. Well, Jeremiah in the Old Testament represents only one mainstream, the terrible alternative. But remember for just a moment our Lord, the Christ. On that day that we now call the Palm Sunday, that massive nonviolent movement that saw Jesus moving from Bethany into the center of the city. Multitudes of people around him applauding, shouting Hosanna, thinking that indeed this is the Christ, this is the Messiah, expecting from him their own aspirations and expectations of what that represented. But Jesus, on a foil of an ass, is quiet as the procession moves to the Mount of Olives and he looks across that city. We're told that Jesus begins to weep. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, would that even today you knew the things that make for peace. But now they are hid from your eyes. And he goes on, according to the Gospel of Luke, to describe the siege that would come about Jerusalem, not one stone left upon another, because Jerusalem did not know the time of its visitation. A terrible alternative that Jesus lifts up for his own day. Well, people of God, we live in such a time as that also. People of goodwill all around the world, the churches of every race and every creed, of every land, of every language, in every continent of our globe, men and women who love life, who have some sense that they know the source of life itself, we are faced with the terrible alternative. We will either will the defeat of the policies and the practices of the nations of the earth today, or we will see the destruction of the human family. The nations rage. They rage against God. They rage against humanity. Look at what even our own nation, leading the pack, is doing today. $600 billion for arms and bombs and guns and the weaponry of preparing for war. While 12 million children in the first year of their lives, a year, die from hunger and the concomitant diseases. The nations rage against God's compassion for all of the human family. And any man or any woman or any child who wants life must face the terrible alternative that if the nations succeed, if the direction of their budgets succeed, we will surely die. But let me bring it on into our own time and in our own land. For sisters and brothers of the Christian faith, we Americans face the terrible alternative. If the policies and practices of our nation prevail, we will surely die. if the policies and practices of our nation prevail. Already the handwriting is on the wall. There is a great corrosion of this most remarkable experience of people living on these shores. And I speak not alone of nuclear possibilities, I speak of pollution, but more than that, I speak of the corrosion of heart and mind and spirit that is abroad in this time and in our own land. We face, as the church, the terrible alternative. I say these words, but inwardly I weep. I hear, America, America, God shed his grace on thee and crowned thy hills with brotherhood from sea to shining sea. America, America, why do you stray from the places for which our fathers and mothers sigh? O land of mine, return. Return to the faith of our father Abraham and mother Sarah. Return to the faith of our fathers and mothers who saw the extraordinary possibilities in the settling of this nation. The terrible alternative. Let me say it in another way. And it took me nearly a decade of thinking and reflection and studying in the 70s, before I was finally willing to admit this to myself and to talk about it. It was a long time before I was ready to preach it in my own pulpits or anywhere else in the country, or to write about it, or to discuss it in groups in the community and in my own congregations. But I want to bring it to your attention. You will not like it. You may reject it. That is entirely up to you. But there is a fire within my own bones that if I dare not say it, I know that I will be consumed by the Lord himself. This land of ours, our beloved nation, is the number one enemy to peace and justice in the world today. I almost choke in daring to say those words. For it cuts absolutely against all of our own sensibilities about ourselves. It is against all conventional wisdom. After all, there are so many voices going around crying in the churches, this is the greatest nation on earth. Richard Neuhaus has recently said, God's good hope for the human family, for the earth today, is America. I have to protest. The great hope for the earth today is as it has ever been, Christ the Lord. The great hope for the earth today are sisters and brothers of the Christian church in every land who see themselves indeed as the body of Christ, seeking to make visible the compassion and the hope of the eternal Christ. Those voices are wrong. Our land has become, even perhaps against the intention of we the people, the number one enemy of peace and justice in the earth today. Let me just describe briefly the experience that brought this most forcibly to my attention. As a black American from my parents, I learned something of the heritage of Africa. And as I've moved through public schools in Ohio
and in four or five different states of the country now. I've read, on the one hand, the textbooks in the classroom, but I've also read, on the other hand, the histories of Africa and black histories of the United States, the literature of the Du Boises and the Frederick Douglasses and my own people. So I've had a long, keen interest in what was going on in Africa. As a student at the end of the World War II in high school, I watched with great interest events all around the world and realized that things were stirring in Africa. Made my first trip of some 6 weeks traveling across Africa on my own in 1956. Now, why was all of this important? Because from the 14th century, Africa has experienced the invisible Holocaust literally out of the sight of millions of people, though the population of Africa was decimated, according to a great variety of historians and sociologists, of somewhere between 60 and 200 million people died in the African slave trade, as Africa was carved up and Western civilization essentially took it over and imposed upon it its own rule and order. In the 20th century, the stirrings of Africa have gone, in part the seeds laid by Christianity and the Christian faith in different ways. But people beginning to say, we ought to be independent. We ought to be out from under colonial rule. And as that has occurred in place after place in Africa over the last 30 years, the United States, my country, has refused to support a single independence movement on the continent of Africa. There's one exception. That exception was that when Jimmy Carter and Andy Young were in the administration, they kept the window open just slightly, and Zimbabwe slipped through. But it's the one exception in all of that continent. And right today, our military missions advise the Union of South Africa, our napalm is being dropped in places like the jungles and villages of Angola, and our policies are to preserve the apartheid of Southern Africa and to keep that section of Africa, if no other section, under the governance of the old colonialism. My land has become the number one enemy of peace and justice at home and abroad. After all, a part of the untoward generation of our times is the mythology with which we have cloaked ourselves. We lift up Russia as the superpower, and we say that she can destroy us many times over, and that's the only extent to which she is a superpower. But in the 20th century, we are the American Empire. We are the Babylonian Empire of the 20th century. Of all of written history, no nation has known the power, the wealth, the cultural grip upon the world, the military power that our land has. The Third Reich would have loved the tremendous wealth that we have in our shores. We are the economic, the money center of the earth. The 500 largest corporations of the earth, oftentimes with tentacles in 50, 60, or 100 nations around the world, have their headquarters in the United States. No nation compares. Genghis Khan would have liked 3,000 military bases on every continent as we have them. No nation has ever known that sort of military power. We are the media capital of the earth.
Los Angeles is the media city of the earth, the satellites, the network power, the movie industry that goes all around the world. No country, no civilization has ever experienced that kind of power. We are the technological center of the world, notwithstanding our refusal to accept the Austrian invented oxygen furnace for making steel, or the modernization that we needed to do at a critical times in our economy. We are the technological center of the world. The technology to either remake the face of the earth, or to destroy it. We are the number one enemy of peace and justice. In Jeremiah's day, the Zephaniahs insisted, no, no. This land is forever blessed. This land does not fall under the doctrine of sin or decay. This people are the chosen people. God will never abandon. But it's not God who had abandoned Judah. It was Judah who had abandoned God. Dear sisters and brothers, we face the terrible alternative of willing the victory of current practices of our nation and thereby our own death, or willing the defeat of the practices of our nation and giving ourselves and our children in our world a chance for a future of grace and strength. Well, Jesus said it so very well. Jerusalem, Jerusalem, would that even today you knew the things that make for peace, but now they are hid from your eyes. What are the things that make for peace? Well, the way through peace, the way to peace, is first of all through peace. The way to peace is indeed through peace. Popular wisdom tells us over and over again that we gain peace through war. Through military might, we achieve solution to political and economic questions. But Jesus inserted that by their fruits ye shall know them. But a banana tree will not produce walnuts. That there is in the universe a moral order, that we reap what we sow. Soren Kierkegaard said it another way when he asserted that ends and means are one and the same thing. That our good intentions must also have good methods. You cannot achieve good goals through devious and deceptive and evil means. Mahatma Gandhi said it still another way, that the end is to be found in the means. And the means, even if they are unsuccessful, if they are nevertheless firm means in the right, they are victorious even in the process though they may fail to reach their goal. Martin Luther King Jr. said it still another way. He said, hate will never overcome hate. Hate against hate only multiplies hatred in the world. The old concept of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth means that eventually everyone in the world is blind and toothless. Darkness cannot be overcome by darkness. Only light can overcome darkness. Hatred can only be transformed by love. Evil by good. The way to peace is indeed through peace. And so when Jesus the Christ stands astride human history and says, peace I give to you, my peace I leave with you, not as the world gives, give I unto you. That peace that Christ is talking about is not an ephemeral, hopeless, helpless power. It is rather the very power of God for the transformation of life. And hence the New Testament cries out that the same power by which Christ is raised from the dead is the power by which God's kingdom can transform the human scene, and turn the darkness into light and the despair into hope. The way to peace is through peace. We of the churches must begin to take on the principalities and powers in our own time. It is not enough, dear friends, to keep saying that we win one soul at a time. There is great evidence that for every person that somehow we are able to see baptized and converted, we place them back in an untoward environment that hammers home again and again the popular wisdoms that will keep them from the discipleship that Christ offers and Christ claims. I became aware of this very deeply in another way. Some of you, I know, are aware of the great burden upon our churches today of trying to care for the shelterless and for the hungry. For years, our Holman congregation has had such a program, an emergency assistance program that we call our storehouse. And we have watched it in the last 5 years summarily go beyond all of the boundaries of our compassion and of our resources. Families, white, yellow, red, black, brown, from all around the city, who are referred to us by social agencies, even other churches. Oftentimes, a police car will roll up into our parking lot, and a police officer will bring a family into us and say they've found them somewhere. They're hungry, and they have no place to go, and will you do something about it? I've engaged in such ministries now for over 23 years in every congregation that I've been a part of. But I've begun to realize that for every family we manage to feed for a time or even to find shelter for or buy them medicine or get them transportation to someplace, standing in their place are five more families. And we pick them up and we bandage them and give them aid and we find 10 more families. Because we can't move fast enough against the machinery that's doing the crippling. And I'm therefore absolutely convinced that this is why Jesus walked into the temple in his own day and began to overturn the money tables. Because he recognized that it was essential that he not only move at the point of healing the sick and raising the dead, but that he also had to move against the temples of corruption, the institutions of corruption that were crippling his people and refusing to let them go. Dietrich Bonhoeffer has another parable which I think is utterly important for our time. He tells of a highway, perhaps a freeway. There has been a massive fire, firebombing in the city. The city is in flames. The people have grabbed whatever they could out of their houses and are fleeing. The freeway is jam-packed, literally, by hapless people pushing and struggling and stammering to get away from the Holocaust. Under that highway careens a tractor trailer, the hands of the driver on the horn. The trailer disregards the struggling humanity, and it moves over people, pushes people aside, killing some, injuring others. Bonhoeffer asserts that the Christian today cannot stand on the shoulder of the road and cry out to the driver, stop. The Christian must, with his body, throw himself into the way of that trailer and stop it with his very body. Therefore, the way to peace is through peace, but the cost of peace is the church learning again to do justice, to love mercy, not alone for itself, not primarily for itself, for the hapless and the hopeless and the helpless around us. The terrible alternative. Remember, in Jeremiah's day, there were many popular priests and ministers. And many people chose Zephaniah rather than Jeremiah. But the people of God, by the grace of God, named the book of that time Jeremiah. In Bonhoeffer's day, there was a vigorous church movement. They sought to blend the gospel into the purposes of the Third Reich. They rejected Bonhoeffer. They chose a civil religion. And after the war, in some of their writings and in conversations with them, there were many German Christians who said, we did not know. We did not know. When the revelations of the death camps came to the attention of the world, there were German Christians who said, I didn't know it. They did not know the things that make for peace. They chose wrongly. Even in Jesus' day, the popular crowds chose Caiaphas over Jesus. Always in an untoward time, we must make a choice between the way of life and the way of death. And even within our churches, we will choose disastrously Caiaphas rather than the Christ. When you and I read the New Testament over and over again, we identify ourselves with Jesus. But I'm trying to teach myself to read the New Testament not by pretending that I stand in the feet of Jesus, but by understanding that indeed the seeds of Caiaphas are in Jim Lawson, that Christ speaks to me in a perpendicular, prophetic fashion. Many chose Caiaphas. How will we of the church choose in our own time? As for me, I dream a dream. I dream a dream where man, woman, child, no other will scorn. Where love will bless the earth and peace and paths adorn. I dream a world where all will know sweet freedom's way, where greed no longer saps the soul, nor avarice blights our day. A world I dream where black or white or yellow or red or brown, persons of whatever creed or race will share the bounties of the earth, and every man and every woman and every child in every place is free, where wretchedness will hang its head, and joy like a pearl attend the needs of all humankind. Of such I dream. Our world, the seed of peace is repentance, the hope of peace is compassion, the understanding of compassion is justice. How will you choose? How will the church choose?